Disclaimer: the views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. It's 2012. This is our first show of what is shaping up to be not a wonderful year, but, you know, we'll see. It's only January yet. I'm Zach Burchie. Justin's here.
We have 11 whole months for the rest of the sky to cave in. Yeah.
Not a lot of great news right out of the gate this year. Actually,
no, this is already, we're not even 2 weeks into January and it's already shit.
Yeah, I mean, we've been through periods like this before, I will say.
Yeah.
And at this point, though, the options for recovery are limited. But so people know what we're talking about. There's been a bunch of bad news. Basically, Bandai Entertainment USA is downsizing to the point where they will no longer be releasing new titles. They're going to keep their catalog in stock and in print for as long as I guess they can. But they are done for the most part. They are finished. I don't know. What do you think, Justin?
Well, I think a lot of us were kind of predicting that this would happen at some point. We just didn't know when.
Yeah.
You know, this division was clearly not doing well. Their new releases had slowed to a trickle. Their marketing was kind of, you know, coming apart at the seams. They clearly, from a very even outside perspective, didn't really look like they were doing good. So, you know, maybe they could have kept going for another couple of years, like Yudomi was saying, but it basically amounts to a mercy killing by their parent company. And with physical media dwindling, it's hard to argue with that.
Well, yeah, and it's important to point out this was not a traditional sort of bankruptcy or insolvency or whatever. This was the parent company saying, yeah, all right, well, we're done with that.
Right, as opposed to, say, Genion, that was
right.
A giant train wreck. This is like a minor fender bender where you decide that the car is totaled.
Yeah, well, no, or like the car is pretty much totaled, and you're like, you know what, I'm just going to get a new car.
Yeah, it was a junker anyway.
Yeah, I likened it to like Genion was a house collapsing during an earthquake. This is a controlled demolition.
Right.
So yeah, they basically decided to take it out, and we've all known this was coming. Maybe not. Nobody really knew how long it would last. I mean, I was, you know, we've been talking about this back and forth, and I said, like, if you went back in time 5 years and told 5 years ago us, hey, Bandai and Media Blasters, who we'll get to in a bit, they're both going to be around until 2012. I think we probably would have been like, eh, really?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that people don't realize is, you know, even though nobody knows sales numbers for a lot of these titles, we get told a lot of things in confidence that we're just like, ooh, really? Oh, that sounds awful.
Yeah, the fact that they survived this long is a minor miracle. And it's very sad to see them go. A lot of great people work in there. And Bandai's had a huge legacy in this industry. You know, I mean, we've all been, you know, buying their shit for 10, 12 years. They had a huge impact on anime in America, and their contribution should not be forgotten or overlooked. So it's sad to see them go, but you know, from a business perspective and from an industry perspective, not exactly the apocalypse, not an Armageddon, but a fond and sad farewell to the inevitable, I think.
Yeah, and it just contributes to the very uncertain shifting sands that make up our domestic DVD market, and things are changing very fast, and I wasn't really expecting them to all happen at once.
Yeah, it's been very tumultuous, and you know, we'll talk about the physical media market in a bit, but first, you know, the next thing we should mention is Media Blasters is also basically, well, okay. They have announced that they've let go 60% of their workforce, which, who is that exactly that left the company? Do you know?
For the most part, it seems to be their entire production team. From what I've heard, they're down to mostly administrative people.
Right.
As one would, as would be indicated by this sort of thing. Keep in mind, Media Blasters used to be the sort of company that used to do all their authoring in-house, used to do all of their print design in-house, as opposed to, say, Bandai, which outsourced all that stuff, so they could tick by with five people for a couple of years. Media Blasters did everything in-house, and all those people are gone now. And they're trying to kind of replicate the old Bandai model, which was, you know, hire those people as needed on a freelance basis.
Right. And, you know, more, I hope that that works out for them, but... It didn't work out for Bandai so well. And, you know, we don't really know exactly what kind of condition that company is in. I would hesitate to be really optimistic about what's really happening there. I wouldn't be a total downer about it. Surely they have a chance. That's a spunky, scrappy little company that has dodged more than its fair share of bullets. And this might be the big bullet that they somehow managed to get around. But, you know, I mean, all the stuff that they're announcing just today, they announced their license rescued. They didn't announce it so much as they posted box art for a Fushigi Yugi collection that they claim will be out in April. No press release, no nothing. I would be cautiously skeptical about that actually seeing release. I wouldn't call it. I wouldn't say it's not going to happen. I would say let's keep our expectations at a reasonable place for a company that just fired its entire production team. Maybe.
Right. And this is the sort of thing where I'm like, if you want it, you should probably pre-order it.
Right.
I mean, all I'm doing is I'm flashing back to when Genion, I found out that Genion was closing like 2 weeks before that second Hajime no Ippo box set came out, and I'm like, I'm pre-ordering this. I got it. It was in print for a week.
So if you want that, go ahead and pre-order. And if Media Blasters has anything else out there that's currently in print that you want, snap it up.
Yeah. You know, actually, that goes for the Bandai stuff, too. I mean, Bandai, you don't know too, yeah, how long that they can foreseeably keep that going.
And, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, somebody pointed this out the other day where they felt burned because I guess a couple of years ago we had this exact same conversation about how these companies are in trouble. If you want something, get it. Well, now they're actually going down. You know, we might have been overly cautious before. But now I would say, you know, if you want the stuff, just get it. Why are you waiting? You want it? Buy it. While you can still reasonably get it and you don't type it into Amazon and somehow three numbers pop up instead of two. You know, and this stuff is already going up in price. I've been watching that Evangelion box on Amazon. All it does is go up in price. The used copies just go up, 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 up.
Which is hilarious because I think Right Stuff still has them in stock.
Oh, they do, but we don't know
for 30 bucks.
We don't know for how much longer that's going to last. So,
that is true.
You know, I mean, don't take that as an excuse to say, oh, wait till it's on sale or whatever. Like, you want it, buy it, for Christ's sake.
Now, we're coming to the point now where the only market that it makes sense to financially support with DVD releases are the hardcore collectors.
Which is a shift that we are seeing. A lot of these companies, you know, Bandai's out, but their parent company will be offering shit to Region 1 customers.
At a very high price.
At a very high price. But, you know, that for those companies, that business model works. Now, these, you know, another thing that's important to point out, we can contrast Media Blasters and Bandai, two struggling companies that never really got a digital strategy off the ground whatsoever. We can compare these to the two ostensibly successful-looking Region 1 companies that remain, which are, you know, the big Region 1 companies, Funimation, Sentai. They both have big digital strategies. They both invested in it. They both looked at the market and said, what can we do here? They didn't let themselves get outdated. And that's
even Viz. I mean, if anything, Viz has been ahead of the curve on this, where they kind of gave up on the cheap mass market DVD market and went just pure Hulu and Netflix.
And the occasional box set, yeah.
Yeah.
They still do DVDs, but only for stuff they know they can sell, like Bleach and Naruto, you know, shit like that. But these are companies that are being smart about it. And you have these other two companies, not that they were dumb, but they didn't change with the times. And what happens to media companies especially that don't change with the times? Well, they fade away. So it's important to make that distinction and not to look at the failure of Bandai and Media Blasters, ostensibly the failure of Media Blasters, as, oh, this is doom, death, and destruction for everybody. It's like, well, looking at these two cases, the writing was on the wall.
Yeah, and This is going to be a really difficult time for everyone in the media business, because this is really a time of great change that we haven't seen before. The entire industry became dependent on physical media in a way that it never has with the coming of DVD. Yeah. Now that DVD is kind of becoming passe and old technology, everyone's going to have to struggle to adapt on every level, from consumer all the way up through giant Hollywood studio. And it's going to be a rough go of things for a couple of years. Yeah. We don't know how things are going to shake out in the end.
It's a very interesting time. And, you know, what's happening to anime, like we always say, is a little petri dish for the entertainment industry. So we're starting to see, you know, little companies that have been struggling for a long time finally go away. And the big companies are still there, but they're struggling with their strategies as well. You know, nobody really knows what's going to happen. I'm sure there's plenty of people out there willing to predict. I think you have a good point with the whole, like, boutique sort of releases, where you're a hardcore collector, you're willing to spend $80 on a Blu-ray, they're going to market shit to you because you're the one paying their bills.
Right. The NIS Aniplex model with probably a little bit of adjustment.
Yeah, and NIS is a really good example of a publisher that can survive in this environment. They've decided on a business model that appears to be working for them, as far as I know.
Yeah, from all accounts, I can tell, you know, the hits are good enough. They spend very little money. They do everything in house, right. So they're just spending more or less the license fee and a little bit of production cost to make those nice books, and that's it. And because the margins are so tiny now, that they can eke out a profit. Works pretty well.
Right. And then they have this other thing that's their actual source of real revenue, which is video games, which is where all the money is now. But
right.
You know, we're seeing, and that's an inventive way to do it. Like, I remember years ago when they announced that they were getting into this business, we were all like, oh, man, someone getting into DVD. And it's like, well, if they decided they wanted that shit in Walmart, yes, that would be stupid. But the way that they went about it was smart. Like, they had a good business model.
Right, and the fact that they're only selling online, I think, also makes a big difference, and that's probably why Aniplex is doing okay, too.
Yeah.
They're keeping their expectations low, and they're adjusting their how much they pay out to match.
Yeah, so, you know, again, this is like people who are innovating and paying attention to the business, paying attention to the market, they're going to survive, and they're going to be okay. People who are relying on the old model are saying, oh, man, if I don't get 20,000 units into Best Buy, we're finished. Like, okay, dude.
that's a really tough mindset to adjust to, though.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're going from selling 20,000 units to 3.
Right.
And that seems like failure. That smells like failure. But you're still making a profit at the end of the day, because you don't have to deal with wholesale. You don't have to deal with returns. You don't have to deal with everything having to get dubbed or they won't stock it. It works better in a way.
Well, yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's a little bit of heartening there. It's almost like the little, you know, you have the barren landscape and you see the little grass shoot come up. It's like, well, some people have figured it out. You know, like, they figured out a way to make money. And it's all about managing, I think, what percentage of it is just managing your expectations for profit?
I think that's really, you hit the nail on the head there. Whenever a bubble bursts, the bubble is the realization that, oh, yeah, everyone wasn't going to buy this. This wasn't going to keep going up and up. This isn't for everybody.
Yeah.
And so the managed expectation, and I think the realistic expectation, is that, oh, yeah, we are never going to get Oreimo into Best Buy and do 100,000 units. This is not a mainstreamable property.
No shit.
and so, you can say that about 98% of anime being made, maybe more these days.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it seems like, based on the strategy I've seen, even when you do walk into Best Buy, the stuff that's on the shelf is Dragon Ball, Full Metal Alchemist, stuff that sells at that market level. You know, you see some of the niche stuff, but mostly it's that, you know, the stuff that actually does sell. So, you know, and Funimation always tells us, like, Best Buy, we're not too concerned about them. You know, our business model is mostly like Amazon, right, stuff, shit like that for physical. I kind of take their word on that just based on, like, the last time I saw an anime shelf in a Best Buy. It's mostly DBZ. you know? Which
yeah, it varies a lot by location.
It does, but by and large, that's what you find when you look at an anime section, Dragon Ball.
Right.
So
and Best Buy, you know, they're only going to be shrinking their DVD selection going forward, and that the few stores left that stock a lot of different anime titles, those are probably going to get cut pretty soon.
Yeah, you know, in a way, it's almost like this era of change, this shift. I almost wish it would happen faster just so we can see where it goes and figure out, like, okay, here's how we profit on creative product in the new media market.
Careful what you wish for.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying, like, the uncertainty is annoying.
Oh, annoying. try being John Cirabella.
Yeah, there you go, right. But, you know, hey, look.
It's an ulcer.
All we can do is sit back, watch, observe, and be rational and reasonable about what we are seeing.
Right, and stop expecting everything to be so cheap, because honestly, what we've been holding out for the last 3 or 4 years as far as really, really cheap DVDs, those have been fire sale prices. No one's been making money off those.
Yeah, the whole, like, anime needs to be cheap thing, well, but it's not a cheap product. It just isn't. It's a luxury product. It's a niche item. It is not something that you get 48 episodes for $17.99.
Yeah, when Funimation puts a title out on their save line and it's like 26 episodes for $18 or whatever it is, no one's making much money off that. We're talking maybe $5 is going back to the licensor for the whole show.
No, and they said as much. It's like, this is because we don't know how much longer we're leaving to have this license. This is about to expire. We'll eke whatever pennies out of it we can at this point, and then that's it. I mean, they said as much. You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't think that the price, you know, your average box set is what, $59.99, $69.99?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a decent price point, right? Or is it?
Well, it's all what you're comparing it to. I mean, compared to those save box sets, it seems pretty expensive. Compared to what we used to pay back in the 90s, it's dirt cheap.
Well,
compared to what the Region 2 companies will charge us, it's really cheap.
I mean, for that company, like that price point, they will make money on that.
It honestly probably depends if they dub it or not.
Yeah, the other big question. But anyway, the economics of this whole thing is a mess. And you've actually got an article coming up about the whole thing.
Yeah, I'm working on a series of articles about how much money that the Japanese producers can expect to get from every different corner of the business, whether it's America or Japan or DVD or online. And I think people will be really shocked at how little America contributes to their bottom line.
Well, we'll find out, but 2012 is not shaping up to be an easy year, I guess, for the industry. But again, man, having watched this for so many years now and looking at it, it's like we've been here. Like the end of 2000 was 2007 or 2008 was like the most depressing year. Maybe we're getting into worse territory than even that, but who knows?
Hey, this is one of those times when even the most informed people in the world have no idea what the next 6 months are going to hold.
Yeah, we'll find out, though. All right, man. Well, let's go ahead and get on to the show. Okay, we're back. My guest this week, it's the Super Manga Pals with Deb Aoki, manga editor at About.com. Hey, Deb.
Hi.
And from comicsworthreading.com and the Manga Out Loud podcast, which you can find at mangaoutloud.com, it's Ed Sizemore. Hey, Ed.
Hey, I want to be the Wonder Mutt.
I call the Great Gazoo, even though it has nothing to do with any of that. All right, so it's 2012. We're going to go through the obvious topics, you know, what we're going to cover. But I want to know what you guys have been just reading lately. Like, what's on your nightstand? What's sitting on your desk? What's in your to-do pile that you've been reading lately? I guess, Deb, we'll start with you.
Well, I just got Durarara from Yen Press. I've been enjoying that.
Yeah.
It's actually pretty – it's a nice adaptation of the anime. Although I have to admit, maybe with the anime, I kind of lost interest midway.
Yeah, me too.
So I'm kind of looking forward to reading the manga, seeing if, well, it's worth checking out the anime again. Other than that, I've been reading this book called Breathe Deeply. It's from One Piece Books. It's kind of a medical manga about two two young men who become doctors and they try to create artificial heart. It's an interesting read when you read it, because I read it right after reading the last volume of Blackjack by Osamu Tezuka, which is another medical manga.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can kind of read it and go, oh, okay. This is the kind of story that Osamu Tezuka would have done way more entertainingly, but, you know.
Is it like, what's the tone? Is it really serious?
It's way too serious.
Oh, okay.
And the art's so-so. I'm trying to give it a good read. Some people, other critics have read it and loved it. I guess my hang-up is that because I'm really a big fan of the art, and the art has it serves the story, and if the art doesn't live up to the promise of this, doesn't live up to it, if the art doesn't keep up its end of the deal, I have a hard time loving something.
Oh, but, really? Okay.
So, you know, that's kind of me. And, of course, the last volume of Blackjack and the second volume of Drops of God, which I love.
Is that out?
Yes. Second volume? Yes. It came out in December.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't notice that. Huh. Well, there you go. Okay, well, that's no surprise that you're keeping up with Drops of God. I don't think anyone's remotely shocked by that. Ed, what's been on your pile?
Let's see. Wandering Sun, Volume 2, came out recently, and I got to read that. And that's an amazing series. Each volume, I just end up falling in love with it a little bit deeper. Beautifully nuanced, subtle storytelling. I would love for us to get more of it. But unfortunately, I also know that the mangaka has kind of slowed down her production. So it's one of those. If we catch up to the Japanese, then all I'm going to do is end up being tortured by waiting for her next volume to come out anyway. So, let's see. Drops of God 2, I just got, so I haven't had a chance to read it, but I enjoy that series too. Twin Spike just came in. I haven't had a chance to open the book yet, but that's another one I'm following. And then 20th Century Boys. And Princess Knight Volume 2, which I finished, and which is it's just a wild ride. That's you'll hear a lot of reviews talk about the last half of the second book. It just derails and never comes back. But he does so much crazy stuff in that last like quarter of the story. He cannot tie up all those loose ends. It's just there is no way to bring everything together. So, you know, what he ends up, you know, ending with works. I think it's probably as best as he could do after all the crazy directions he took it in.
So, I mean, would you call the ending satisfying?
I think so. Other people have not been as happy with it as I am. And maybe that's because I had heard some advance warning that it doesn't have like a real conclusion. It's more of like, he just stops telling the story at a almost kind of like a, and then they went off in the sunset and lived happily ever after kind of thing, you know? So it's, you know, it has that kind of an ending to it, which is fine. I mean, I don't need everything tied up neatly. I like a little open ending.
I hear there's a sequel too, like of the adventures of the prince and princesses, son and daughter. I'm a little fuzzy on that, like what exactly happens in that one, but I think Tezuka knew that it kind of ended on that kind of note too. I mean, well, look, you know, he kind of, if you know Tezuka, he was working on, a lot of times he was working on several series at the same time under very hardcore deadlines. And sometimes I get the vibe, particularly with Princess Knight, that he was just making shit up as he went along.
Right, and this one is
very improvisational.
Yeah, this one's really crazy because when it actually had three printings, and during the first printing is when he was doing Astro Boy and I think Jungle Emperor Leo as manga, and he was also beginning. Oh no, because it was the 50s, but then he went back and had it reserialized in the 60s. And decided to touch up some of the story, and then of course when it was published in the 70s in book format, he decided that he wanted to touch up the story again. So it's a little hard to figure out some of this is like, well, some of this stuff in the end, stuff that he threw in the 60s and the 70s because he wanted to play with the story more and then just realized he didn't have the room to do what he wanted, or it's really hard sometimes with Tezuka because he does like to play with his stuff.
It's really hard to say. I mean, it's Princess Knight is one of those books that, you know, I mean, one of the very first anime I ever watched was Princess Knight back in the day. So this is kind of a sentimental favorite for me. But again, this was something that I watched when I was 6 or 7 years old. So I barely remember the plot. All I remember is, you know, oh, there's this fairy, and oh, look, she rode a horse and she had a sword, and it was so exciting. But, you know, my memory of what the story was like was a little fuzzy until I picked up the books. And it was like, oh, was this what this was about?
See, I think your reaction is really the reason why it became such a phenomenon in Japan. Because I think a lot of people did the same thing. A lot of the mangaka, particularly the shoujo mangaka, who list this as influential, I wonder when they got started and they were thinking about Princess Knight as an influence, how many of them really remembered the story as much as they just remembered this, you know, it's okay to have a strong feminine hero. And I can have a feminine hero who rides horseback and is a great swords fighter and can have all the same adventures that a boy can have, and it doesn't diminish her femininity.
Say that, you know, at that point, I mean, mind you, at that point in my life, I had no idea about gender politics. And no idea that it was unusual for there to be a female lead who was,
right,
you know, strong and dynamic and kind of ambisexual, you know. So, but, you know, it was exciting and it was something I enjoyed reading. And it was something that later on when I went to Japan, when I was in my elementary school years and, you know, my cousins gave me shoujo manga. It was just natural. It was just, oh, yeah, great. You know, comics for girls, right on. And it was part of this whole evolution of my fandom that it wasn't until like 1992 or something like that when I went to Comic-Con for the first time and discovered, oh, it's not a girl world.
Wow.
Or at least not here. You know, yeah. And then manga came, and then, of course, Sailor Moon and all that stuff, and everything changed. You know, so the rest of, you know, comics fandom, I felt caught up to what I already knew and what I already loved about, you know, manga and comics, that, you know, it was just as interesting for a female reader, and you didn't have to read superhero books that were coincidental about interesting relationships, like X-Men is about interesting relationships and Teen Titans and Legion of Superheroes. You know, those were the kind of superhero comics that were interesting to me because it wasn't just about beating up people. It was about the relationships between the characters. But this is stuff that I only dissected years later, you know, why I like something and what, you know, what kind of things appeal to me. So Princess Knight, you know, I'm reading it now and this is years, decades later. it's hard for me to be really neutral about it. Because it's something I'm thinking, like, you know, if I was 8 years old now and I was reading this, what would I think of it? I don't know.
Is it because the gender politics in it are kind of effed up, from what I understand?
Yeah. It's a little strange because, I mean, you know, we're talking years later. I mean, you know, now girls nowadays are much more aware of gender politics, I think.
Yeah.
You know. And much more aware of, you know, sexism, mm-hmm. I guess. And, you know, Tezuka, you know, God rest his soul, is not really, to me as a post-feminist person who went through the ringer and whatever, who can read this and go, wow, you know, this is his strongest, most beloved female character.
Well, no one is going to make the argument that Tezuka was pre-feminist, any sort of feminist anything.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
a big, that's the big complaint about him is that, hey, that guy is way sexist. And his comics are really sexist, and there's kind of no getting around that. Yeah. I don't think.
I try to swallow that, you know, try to ignore that as best I can. And just like, woo, look at the panels, look at the art.
Well,
look at how inventive he is, and I try to ignore the rest of it.
You just have to take it in context. You have to put it in the historical context it's in, you know. You're reading a 50-year-old comic book from a country that is not known for its blisteringly progressive gender politics.
Yeah, so. I try not to hold that against it, but you know, I read it, it's a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's like watching old movies, you know, where they're treating women like garbage.
Yeah, you know, like Song of the South, for example.
Yeah, or something like that. Yeah,
you have to just take it like that.
Well, and you know, he tries a little bit in Princess Knight to at least suggest breaking out of like traditional roles, because there is early in the manga and then later in the end of it, they do deal with the whole issue. Like the law of the land is no woman can sit on the throne.
Right.
And they do complain about that, and that's a little heavy-handed. But when I'm reading it, I guess as a male, and thinking the fact that it, you know, this originally ran in like 1953, I give him some points for trying, even if he's not necessarily successful, because there are, it's like on one level, he's trying to break out of the mold, but on another level, when you're trying to break out of the mold, particularly as a male trying to write empowered females, I think it's really difficult. I mean, you're going to fumble a lot, and he fumbles a lot in the gender politics of this. But you know, like I said, at least he tried. I have to give him you know, an A for effort, even if I can't give him an A for execution.
I mean, the two books you mentioned are basically two ends of the spectrum. You've got Wandering Sun, which is extremely sensitive about gender politics and gender identity. And then you've got, separated by several decades is Princess Knight, where a girl gets a boy, has a boy and a girl's heart, and she has to wrestle between her feelings of wanting to be a boy and wanting to be a girl.
Mm-hmm.
She really that way. So, I mean, which is, if you look at it from that point of view, when 60s, 70s tackling this subject, that's extremely avant-garde. You know?
Yeah, you just gave someone an idea for their term paper. Congratulations.
That's right. But, you know, so it's, you know, in Japan is, I think a lot of people find Japanese anime and manga very fascinating because Japanese culture has a different relationship to expressing gender sometimes, you know, like the kabuki actors who play both male and female parts, Takarazuka, which the females play both the male and female parts, you know, and a lot of anime manga, which has a lot of gender bending, you know, Ranma one half, you know. So this is that kind of, you know, the fact that we can name several on right off the top in anime and manga, and I can't really name that many in American comics. Can you?
Comics, no, but you know, there's plenty of that sort of thing in other forms of entertainment, but maybe not in comics. Yeah.
True, true. Yeah. This is Doubtfire.
anyway. Well, okay. Yeah, there are better examples than that, but okay.
I'm sure there are. I couldn't think of anything off the top of my head.
That's interesting, though. You could really contrast those two. You've made some interesting reading choices to double up on there, Ed.
Okay.
I went in the wildly opposite direction from any kind of positive or progressive gender politics. I read the latest volume of Gantz. I assume it's the latest volume. It's 19. I think this is the newest one.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So I think this is pretty much close to the end. I think the last one is coming up here. Because in this book, they like half the cast gets to 100 points. You know, you get to 100 points in the Gantz game, and you get to either escape or... you get better weapons, or you can bring someone back to life. And so in this volume, like, they kill the big bad at the very first couple of pages, and then they all go back to this room, and the rest of the volume is them deciding what to do with their question. And so a bunch of people get brought back to life from the beginning of the story. They get brought back to life, and then Kay, spoiler alert, decides to go back to his life. And it doesn't end, though. It does not end. He reconnects with his girlfriend, and they both have lost their memories, and they start trying to sort of reconnect and get their memories back. And then the end of the volume is he meets this guy, and he's like, hey, are you Kei Kurono? And he's like, yes, I am. Volume ends. So I think I don't know where else the story could go. I don't know, but yeah, I guess they're close to the end. I can't remember how many volumes it went. I think it might have gone like 21, but I know it's over or almost over.
Really? I thought it's still continuing.
That's what I thought too. Hang on just a second.
Yeah. Like I know that like there are different story arcs. Like there's the red story arc, there's the blue story arc, there's the white story arc.
Right. Yeah, and this is the very this is clearly like close to, it has to be close to the end. If it's not, then what the hell?
It could be like Death Note, you just restart over with change the villain, that's all.
Oh God. Okay, no, they're at 32 volumes in Japan.
Wow!
So yeah. Not even close then.
No, I don't know. Well, yeah, I don't. I kind of envy you because I lost track of Gantz at about volume 10, and I've been wanting to catch up. I do like the series a lot.
Yeah, I read it, you know, you can blow through these pretty quick. So you know, when a new one comes in every 8 months, 7-8 months, a year, or whatever. Uh-huh. I'll read through it, and it's not hard to remember what happened. You know, it's not a particularly complicated story. It's kind of hard keeping his girl because Kei has like it seems like a couple of like a lot of different girlfriends, and they kind of start looking the same after a while. So it's hard to keep them straight. But yeah, no, whatever. It's apparently there's a long way to go, so not anywhere near the end of that story.
Well, I mean, I have to admit, I mean, what I'm waiting for is for Dark Horse to have it on their digital platform.
Mm. Yeah, well, that should be coming, right?
I hope so. I mean, I know it's a rights issue. I mean, they have, right now, Dark Horse only has Lone Wolf and Cub, and I think a few of their Kazuo Koike books on their manga side. I don't think they have the digital rights to Gantz yet, but Gantz is also owned by Shueisha Book. So that might be why that's harder. I don't know. I mean, I just, you know, I obviously I buy and read a lot of manga, and the thought of having to spend another 200 something bucks to catch up with Gantz kind of
that's a little
painful.
That's with a lot of these things. Well, speaking of which, so the other thing I read in a very extremely similar vein was the latest Berserk.
Oh wow!
Which I'll admit, I am behind on Berserk. I have missed a couple of volumes here and there. Some shit happened. I mean, I don't really remember. But I picked up the most recent one, and it's pretty standalone, I guess. Griffith like got resurrected, and now he's like basically going to rule the world as you know the hawk on his throne, and he builds like this giant city, gleaming white city with this giant tree of life over it that's going to be like the capital. And so that's the first couple pages. And then it's Guts and crew fighting undead sea pirates and giant ocean vagina monsters for
ocean vagina monsters.
That's what they are. And so they encounter these pirates, and then they go to this deserted, what feels like a deserted island that actually is home to a dark god that is the source of all these vagina monsters. And guess what happens at the end of the volume? Guts fucks up shit. Like, he just fucks everything up. That's Berserk. That's what happens all the time.
It's just named, don't it?
Yeah. The one thing I will say about Berserk, I mean, you know, I read through it, and it was kind of like, as it's been a while since I've revisited this series, and it's sort of, it is a little comfort foody because it's like, ah, man, he's really gonna kill that monster. He's really gonna kill that thing. But the thing about it is, like, you know, there's a new volume of Berserk like every 6 years or whatever. I mean, that's an exaggeration. It's like one a year or something like that. But you look at his artwork, and my God, I mean, for God's sake, like, one page looks like it would have taken him a year to draw it.
It's true.
It's insane. Like, how does he even do this? It doesn't look like manga art. It looks like woodcut or something. It's nuts. Still.
Right.
It's Berserk on so many levels, it's not even funny.
Right, yeah, there you go. So, Berserk. I'm glad I flipped through it. It reminded me. I should go back and catch up and read the whole thing. Because apparently some crazy stuff happened earlier before this. I'm sure it did. But this is one's a little standalone. So, I guess you can kind of
I have to pick that up.
Yeah, you can pick them up here and there.
It kind of sounds like Berserk in in Lovecraft land a little bit.
Yeah, well, yeah, clearly. Actually, that's extremely obvious. They are talking about for ancient gods from, you know, the abyss of time that have come back or whatever. Yeah, it's totally a Lovecraft lift. But I think at this point he's just like, all right, what else can I have Guts kill? Like, what else, what other crazy monsters can he kill? And that's yeah, so...
You know, there's really just not a lot of hard fantasy out any there anymore, is there?
No, but at the same time, like, yeah. This... They've cut... It's at volume 35. They've covered so much hard fantasy territory. I want to say, like, why would anyone else bother? Berserk has probably already done what you're doing. And nice. It looks better, you know? And you can't draw like he can, so why are you bothering?
Yeah, no, I feel that way when I look at Akira sometimes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, why would anyone else try to do a dystopian, you know, post-apocalyptic, you know, Japan story? It's been done, and it's been done better than you.
Right, it has definitively been done, like, unless yeah. you're bringing something new to it. But I would imagine, like, if I'm starting a hard fantasy story, I'd be intimidated as hell by Berserk. It's like, well, I'm not going to be that, so what am I going to be? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a deterrent or not, but at the same time, like, I can't think of a bunch of rip-offs of Berserk. Like, I can't think of a whole bunch of shows or series that just lifted from it, which normally happens when you get, like, a popular series.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. You know, I mean, I guess the production cycle of manga is what it is, it doesn't seem to reward artists who draw very beautiful, detailed backgrounds and very dynamic stories on a weekly basis. I mean, Eiichiro Oda's artwork is retarded. But you know, it's like, what? I mean, he must have an army of assistants to do all that work. Meanwhile, you know, Taito Kubo kind of handles it by drawing almost no backgrounds. So,
right.
And well, then during the huge, you know, double page fight scenes. Okay, and then we're done. Huh.
Right.
Well, right. I mean, because A Bride Story is the one currently that the artwork just floors me.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's insane amounts of detail, and it only gets published a chapter every other month in Japan, if I'm correct. So there's only one book coming out a year, similar to what the Berserk situation. And yeah, I can't imagine how she's making a living at that production rate.
Well, Miura, Berserk sells so well, it doesn't surprise me. Like, it comes out and it's at the top of the charts for like more than a week. I know he makes crazy money making this. Like, it is a big seller.
Right.
Yeah. So I know that that's... Plus, they're making those movies and stuff. So, yeah. It's still... It's like a standard bearer in Japan for that kind of... For, like, a manga. It's a big deal there. Other than that, like, that's... But that's a blockbuster title. Someone else who works that slow, I don't know.
I think A Bride Story comes out monthly. Don't you think Comic Beam is monthly?
Right, but this is where I was getting confused was when I talked to Will Flanagan, who's the translator. I couldn't remember if she was in every issue. I don't think she is, but you're right. It may not be every other issue. She might be doing like 9 out of 12 issues or something. Yeah. But I don't think she's doing I don't believe she's doing all 12 issues every year. She still is taking like a couple breaks in there. So it's even at a monthly rate, that's really hard to make a living when you see what they get paid.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, but, you know, she's done a couple of books, and her books, like her Bride Story was licensed in France, and it's up for the Anglo M Award, actually. So it's not, you know, America is her only market or Japan is her only market. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, there's no anime of Bride Story yet, but there was an anime for Emma, so... I mean, I can't really speak to how much money manga artists make. Obviously, there's no, you know, Emma keychains and dolls and plush and whatever, you know, like a shonen manga. But, you know, when you read her afterwards in A Bride Story, she seems to genuinely love drawing. I mean, just loves it. Like, she just loves drawing all the details on all that, the clothes, the elaborately embroidered clothing. That's nuts. Right.
And she, you know, I mean, for the amount of details that she puts in her artwork, she's actually quicker than I thought she would be. Because is it Comic Natalie?
Yes, they had a video of her drawing.
Right. It's an hour long video. They posted it in 20-minute chunks, showing you her doing like a one page spread, like a splash page, and it's gorgeous. And the one thing that actually surprised me was watching her do the screen tones at the end, because she can whip those out. She, you know, it's all prefab sheets that she's just cut and pasting, but she does that so fast. I was just floored. I didn't know you could do screen tones that fast manually by hand. And she's even in there, like, you know, dirtying them up to give new shading and effect. So very impressive to watch her work.
Yeah, she's definitely a cartoonist. I think if you've ever, when I've shown that book to, you know, people who normally don't, other artists who normally don't read manga, they're floored by her technique. I think she's really an underappreciated artist in the Western comic world. I mean, I'm glad Willem has, you know, the major French comic festival as nominated for it, because I think it's criminal that San Diego Comic Con Eisner Awards has never nominated her, because I think she's truly one of the best artists out there.
Well, maybe this will be her year.
Hopefully so. I mean, they, I'm upset with the Eisners because they snubbed Pluto, and I think they got so much backlash that's why they gave Urasawa an Eisner last year for 20th Century Boys, is because people raised such a stink. They tend to be a little slow in seeing the talent within the manga community until somebody like kind of rubs their nose in it.
Well, this year they have a Bridget from Manga Blog as one of the Eisner judges, so we'll see.
You know? I know. I'm very happy about that too. Very, very happy.
I don't envy her though. That's a lot of books to read.
It is. Oh my god, that's true. It is an insane amount of books to read.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, that's nice to know. We'll have a ringer on the bench.
Boop, boop.
So, all right. So it's 2012. Surely you guys have done your top tens for 2011, right?
Yes.
Yes. So let's get a taste. Let's hear your top fives, because, you know, we talk about anime mostly on this show, and whenever I have you guys on, you know, it's time to talk about comics. And I think, you know, our listeners maybe probably missed a lot of the books that would be on your top fives. So if you happen to have that in front of you, and if you don't, you know, bring it up. Ed, let's start with you. What were your top five for 2011?
Let's see. Onward Towards Our Noble Deaths by and Deb will have to help me. Yes, thank you. Is an amazing book, and the way I describe it in my review, which I know you'll appreciate, Zach, is it's almost a similar story to Paths of Glory, Kubrick's film, because it's so weird that both of them are based on true events. Now, Mizuki was actually a part of the these events, so it's semi-autobiographical. It's about the hardships of being a Japanese soldier in the New Guinea Islands, the lack of food. They literally have to live off of a cup of rice a day. And so they go out and they fish and they forage in the forest. They suffer all kinds of, you know, malnutrition and the heart of it. And the reason for its title is they have the battalion commander is a huge fan of the old samurai stories, in particular one samurai story about a guy who leads his men into a suicide mission knowing that nobody's going to come out alive, and he's kind of hoping that he'll get a similar circumstance when the Americans land on the island and are building a beachhead. It becomes obvious that this is his circumstance, so he, you know, commands them to do a midnight suicide raid on the American forces. Unfortunately, it's midnight, and because of the malnutrition, because of the crazy schedules they've had to keep, half of the battalion gets lost and ends up wandering back to their home base. So they actually don't get killed, and because the command has already forwarded to the Japanese newspapers about this heroic suicide raid on the Americans, they get really upset at the people who survive, and they make them go back into doing a daylight raid to guarantee that none of them come back alive. It's very anti-war. It really comes harshly on the Imperial Japanese government, as well as just the whole military command structure, and even some critiques about Japanese society and its love of suicide and seeing that as heroic way to do battle. It's brilliant. So I highly recommend that one. Wandering Sun, which we've talked about, really love that. Can't say really enough good about it. Really think it's something that everybody should be reading, manga or not. A Bride Story, which we've talked about again, just gorgeous artwork. Another one is A Zoo in Winter by Taniguchi, another great artist who is a phenomenal drawer. And this is a kind of, again, semi-autobiographical about his getting started in manga. He originally started out working at a textile company and wanted to be a textile designer. Some circumstances happened that didn't come. He ended up working as an assistant to a manga artist, and that ended up becoming the trajectory of his life. And it's also about, you know, being there in the late 60s during the student revolutions and all the cultural revolution that's happening. So just, it's really well done. I've always loved his stories, and particularly the ones that have a more personal feel to them. Just him and I seem to think alike on certain things, and so I really connect with it. And then the other one is 7 Billion Needles, which is a vertical book. It's 4 volumes. The third and fourth volume were printed in 2011. It's really good sci-fi. It's a little experimental. It's really hard to explain the plot other than to say it's Earth is invaded by these two beings. One is kind of like an avatar of destruction. One is in kind of an avatar of creation. They kind of have a battle, and then they actually end up going through this process of like evolution and get caught up in like a human evolution, and it gets really kind of strange and surreal from there. But really well written. In fact, it's let's try and think how to pronounce his name. It's Nobuaki Tanado, and it's actually his first series, and I'm floored by that because it's so well written. Everything ends up fitting together so nicely without being forced. It feels really natural. It just feels like this is somebody who's been writing sci-fi for like 10 or 15 years, not somebody who this is his first story. Well, so
it is an adaptation of a famous American sci-fi story, though, you know.
Well, I read the book it's based on.
Yeah, no, but I'm just saying that the premise is not his own, but he takes it into a new direction.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's very loosely, very very loosely adapted on that book, but even then, I mean, I just particularly the later volumes. Just his ability to balance personal and kind of cosmic ideas that just brilliant. So I was really floored by it. So it's kind of been a sleeper. Not a lot of people have given it kind of the try they should. So for sci-fi fans, I would definitely recommend this. So that's my top five.
Cool. All right. Well, I haven't heard of two of those, so I'll have to look those up. That's cool. Yeah, you know, it's kind of when you get down to it, like the top tens of the year, everyone's kind of got the same like 10 or 15 titles. They're just in different orders, which I always find kind of amusing. But it's like that with movies, like that with video games, like that with every form of media when you get to these top 10 lists. But Deb, what are your top fives?
Let's see. Well, I think one that I really enjoyed and I didn't think I would enjoy when I first heard about it is Blue Exorcist. That's by Kazue Kato. It's a Shonen Jump title. It sounds so lame when you hear the concept. It's about a boy who kind of headstrong. He discovers that he is the half-blood son of Satan, and he must become an exorcist to defeat his father. And that sounds so, so lame. But if you read the story, Kazue Kato's art is really wonderful. She creates this really wonderfully realized world that's kind of a mix of modern Japan and kind of Europe. And the characters are really, really fun. You really love come to care about them. The monsters, the demon, the demon culture that is both Asian and Western. I found it to be really, really enjoyable. I didn't think I would, but that's when I was putting together my best of the year list. That was automatically on. I just really enjoyed that one a lot.
How many volumes of that are out now?
I think there are six now.
Yeah, that was cool.
Five or six out now. And the anime is from Aniplex, and that's out. I think it's like 25 episodes, which kind of ties things up at a nice point, but the series does continue. I mean, I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm actually shocked because when I was looking at your critics where you were compiling all the different top 10 lists and showing like which were the major vote getters, the fact that that made the top 10 lists was shocking. And I haven't looked at it, but the fact that so many people have now recommended it, I'm going to have to actually sit down and read it.
Her art is amazing. Her art is really, really wonderful. It's really charming. She does something that what I admire in Kaoru Mori, which is you can tell a lot of what's going on with the characters. You can tell what their personalities are like. You can tell what they're thinking by just how they draw the facial expressions. You know, and each character looks very distinct and has their own way of talking, their own way of acting, which is, you know, speaking from a craft point of view, is kind of hard. Is not something I see very often in manga. Sometimes you'll see like a whole cast of characters who only look different just because one character's hair is slightly more wavy than the other. You know, they all talk the same and they all dress the same. And there's not this interesting dynamic. And I think Blue Exorcist has a really interesting dynamic between the two brothers. One brother is more studious and they're twin brothers. But only one has inherited the power of Satan, so to speak. And you can see that the brotherly dynamic is really fun and interesting to watch. Let's see. What was the other one? Speaking of dysfunctional families, I also really liked No Longer Human by Usamaru Furuya. That's based on I guess I keep telling people it's kind of like it's the Japanese version of Catcher in the Rye. Disaffected youth who just doesn't believe, looks at society and finds it to be lacking, just somehow is outside of, chooses to live outside of society's norms and just kind of looks at normal society from the outside and finds it to be very lacking and very empty, and there's this kind of inner torment. So it's basically about a young man who comes from a very well-to-do family. And he feels very empty inside, like he's always faking a smile and trying to be the class clown. But he, in the end, he's kind of a sociopath, honestly. Like he doesn't really have a soul. So you see him spiral into this cycle of decay and depravity, and who he drags down with him. And it's a very, very dark story, but it's very well done. It's a very modern retelling of a story that was written in the 1940s and is considered a real classic in Japanese literature. There's two volumes out now from Vertigo. I think the third one is the final one, but it's I think I spoke with Ed from Vertigo and he said the third volume just kind of kicks you in the gut. So this is one well worth reading, and it's not a huge commitment. What else? Bride Story, of course, which we've talked about at length. I really love that one. Beautiful story. I have to admit, I like Emma a lot more than Bride Story, story-wise, because I think Bride Story is a little slow. But, you know, I love seeing how she draws and where she's taking the story. And she tells all these slice-of-life stories about, turn-of-the-century Turkey, Middle East, which is really fascinating. She obviously loves her subject very, very much. Wandering Sun, of course. and Drops of God, of course.
All right.
Which I just love. It's just so entertaining and so much fun. And it just makes me want to drink more wine, if that's even possible.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah. So I need to stop putting some of these titles off. I need to get around to some of this stuff. So before we get to Twitter, I gotta ask. We talk about it every time. And last time I had you guys on, I don't think either of you had yet made the shift over to digital. Has that happened for either of you as of this date?
I'm not fully digital. I would say I've gone about 20% digital. Now that Viz is doing One Piece, I think everything I'm following online is through Viz right now. One Piece, because let's be honest, I just don't want to devote the shelf space to that. But I still like the story, and so getting it digitally is perfect for me. Bakuman, which I enjoy, it's a good series. But again, it's not one that I really want to use up shelf space on. And I think for a lot of people, particularly reviewers that I'm talking to, I think the move to digital is being forced less by content and more by physical living condition. all of us are like running out of room in our houses to store books. And so digital is becoming kind of the, I have to go to digital because I can't buy any more books without getting rid of books.
Digital is also very financially attractive.
It is. And, you know, for something like One Piece, where you know it's going to go like 100 volumes, and we're only on volume like 63, I think just came out for Viz, 64 came out in Japan, so you know that you're going to be buying at least another 30 volumes of it. Yeah, I mean, the fact that you're saving half the cover price buying digitally over 30 volumes, that means $150 that you're saving. So, it's not hard to make the commitment to digital for something like that. And then, like, Saturn Apartments is another one, Children of the Sea. So a lot of the Sig Icky books, which I like, but I'm just getting digitally because, again, I enjoy them. But having them digital is just kind of nice because it's easier to get to them and to go back and reread them if I want than it is to try to, you know, dig through storage boxes to figure out where I put volume 3 and where I put volume 4.
I hear you.
Yeah, you know, I have to wonder about that a little bit because, you know, what you're talking about is basically you reserve shelf space for the premium releases and the you know, quote-unquote disposable stuff like volume 78 of One Piece, you just get digitally because, you know, you're going to read that once and then move on.
Right.
So, we're sort of seeing a shift towards that with anime, too. But anyway, Deb, you were saying.
No, that's true. I mean, I feel the same way. I mean, there's some books where I will, if I love it enough, I will always buy the print volume if it's available. Just because there's something kind of nice about having it that way. I don't personally have an iPad myself. I mean, it's getting to the point where I'm starting to feel really dumb for not having one. Yeah. But I have been downloading and reading a lot of stuff from Viz, from Dark Horse on my phone and on my computer. I've been reading a lot of the J-Manga stuff. I get Yen Plus, of course, digitally. It's been really nice. I do think the interfaces are pretty good. It's pretty easy to read. I like that, you know, for example, with J-Manga, for example, that it gives me the opportunity to read books that otherwise would have no chance in hell to be licensed and published in print ever in England.
How is J-Manga doing? Because I feel like I have not even seen a press release from them since the summer.
They've sent out a few. They've sent out, like, oh, we're, yeah, you know, we have this new title, or we're doing this sale, or we're doing this promo.
Right.
But generally, it's pretty quiet.
As far as anything really big, like saying, hey, we have our iPad app, or hey, we have our Android app, and hey, you know, we got this contract with Hakusensha to do this. Nothing big. Nothing on that level.
Well, I was gonna say, they, like, even when they have a new series, it's interesting, they've been using Twitter a lot. So, like, every Tuesday is when their new volumes go up. they'll do a slew of Twitter announcements to say, hey, we picked up volume one of this series, or volume three of this series is now available. They tend to, the press releases tend to be for like sales, one of the complaints for J Manga when it first started was the fact that the volume prices were too high.
Right.
And so the 50% off sale seems to keep rolling around a lot. It's like, you know, 9 out of 10 days, you're going to be able to get those volumes for 50% off the so-called cover price. And then, of course, the other thing they did was for New Year's, everybody who is a subscribing member, they gave an extra 500 points to. Mm-hmm. So as a New Year's gift. So I think they're trying really hard to work with the fans. I just think part of the problem is that, you know, fan expectations in America versus Japanese publisher expectations are you know, a problem, and they're getting caught in the middle of that. So,
But it's also the content, you know, like, you can offer all the manga in the world on, you know, at a great price, but if it's not something people passionately want to read, where are we, you know?
Right, exactly.
So, that's a problem with what they got, because it's stuff that I think, I can handle paying $4.99 to give this manga that I'm not really sure about a try, but I wouldn't pay $10.99.
Right, exactly. I agree with you. That's why, I mean, there was a lot of stuff I wanted to try that I didn't touch because until it went on the 50% off sale, and then I picked up, you know, kind of like a dozen volumes or something. So not realizing that this was going to be one of their eternal sales.
Well, I mean, I hope they keep this pricing because if they ever raise it, I really don't know how long they're going to keep going.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that they don't have an e-reader app is hurting them a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I think once they get an Android and an iPad app going, I think they'll be better positioned, I think, to attract more of an audience. But for as far as digital,
It would help if they also opened up beyond North America, honestly.
Yeah, that's true, too. Because guys like Phil from Ypres Choice over in Ireland – would love to get a hold of a lot of the stuff. So, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of English, England, Irish, Scottish, and Australian.
Yeah,
guys who would love to get a crack at this stuff. It's interesting, you know, we talked about Dark Horse. The one manga that I've enjoyed but I have not bought because of the physical presentation was Lone Wolf and Cub. Because I hated those tiny books. And, you know, and it's got some really gorgeous artwork in it.
It's amazing.
And now that I have an iPad and they're releasing those pages in iPad size, mm-hmm. I'm buying those volumes now because that's the size you need to look at that artwork in and really get the chance to, like, study the details. Because my original experience with Lone Wolf and Cub was some of those old Eclipse pamphlet comics that came out.
Yes. And,
yeah, so I saw them on that size. And then when I saw the Dark Horse version, I was like, I'm sorry, I cannot buy, you know, this book that small. It never made sense to me. So I never picked up any of the stuff from Dark Horse as much as I wanted to read through the series. But digitally, the size makes sense for the art. So now I'm picking it up.
To give their good old friends at Dark Horse a plug, Lone Wolf and Cub is available as volumes, I think. Let's see.
First 10
volumes for $44, $45, which is like $4.50 a volume, which is quite the deal. And it's you know, if you're a manga fan, if you've not read Lone Wolf and Cub, you are so missing out. It's brilliant.
It really is. It's amazing. I actually got hooked based on the one pamphlet, and it was the story To Kill a Buddha. Mm. Which is a brilliant story. And as soon as I read that, I was like, these guys just have so much to say and say it so well. And I just don't want to, you know, ruin – my eyes are already bad enough. I don't want to ruin them trying to read 26 volumes on half size.
Why did they publish – does anyone know why they published that way? Because I never – oh, is that why? Because I never read it either. because
well, it,
of,
it was because yeah. if they tried to print full size volumes in at that thick, it would have to be about $25 a volume almost.
Yeah.
And by doing it at this volume, at that size, at that thickness, for that amount of money, it made it much more appealing to for them to license that entire series, which is, I think, 29 volumes.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
It's quite long.
It
and
is.
That's, so the, I was, you know, being one of the people who bought the original Eclipse volumes, and which only went up to like 10 issues, which was, what, roughly a tenth of that story. The fact that Dark Horse was committed to printing the entire 29 volumes made me so happy. I bought every single one, and I will never sell them because they are awesome.
So, yeah, well, I mean, you know, and I don't blame you. Like, I'm just glad that I'm able to get them in a format and size that I'm comfortable with.
Absolutely. I to tell you the truth, I haven't tried reading the tiny volumes since my eye doctor started saying, you know, you should think about getting bifocals sometime. So we'll see how it feels now.
All right. So, I mean, Deb, you think this might be the year that you go digital for a lot of this stuff?
Oh, I definitely am. I definitely am. I mean, there's now enough really good content to make it worth my while.
Plus, they're saying the next iPad's going to be like twice the resolution or something, which will get me that'll get me to buy one.
Yeah, for sure.
My problem with the iPad as it exists is that it's 1024 by 768, which is basically the resolution of my phone. And if I'm going to have a tablet with a screen that's three times the size or whatever, I want a higher resolution. Like that's a no-brainer. But that's what they're saying. The next one will have a much higher resolution. So that's when I will switch to digital because I'm running into that. I mean, I'm out of shelf space just for books, just for like non-comics books. Mm. So, yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's go ahead and get to Twitter, shall we?
All righty.
Okay. First up from Five Camp, both Italia and this season's Daily Lives of High School Boys originated from web manga. Is there a trend that popular web manga featuring all male casts aimed at girls? Is this a mainstream published manga not supplying this demand, or is that a coincidence? Basically, so the two breakout popular web manga are feature all male casts aimed at girls, which I don't know if Daily Lives of High School Boys is aimed at girls, but yeah, he wants to know if that's a coincidence or what.
No, I think the mainstream manga publishers are serving up lots of harem manga too. You know, I mean, both. You've got your Reborn on the Shonen Manga side, and you've got your Ouran High School Host Club on the female side, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. I don't think there's any shortage of it. I just think that these particular web comics found a particularly a successful formula. I don't think there's, I don't. I mean, I think what the question is suggesting is that. Are these webcomics giving the fans what they want that they're not getting any other way? No. No. There's a lot of it.
Maybe they're just doing it in, I don't know, different ways or whatever. I mean,
I don't think it's any more sexy, honestly.
Well, and Italia is, like, I have to give credit for it being a fairly original idea and taking it in a really unique direction. So, yeah, I think that was just a case of somebody who was really creative, who was probably having difficulty breaking into the normal channels, who just went on the web because it was easier to get the material out there and to find an audience. And so they did, you know, because Italia on paper probably doesn't sound like a great pitch, you know. Yeah, I'm gonna do a boy's love about, you know, World War II, where all the countries are, you know, Bashonen, and they're, won't be anything overt, but it'll be a lot of, like, you know, hinted at romance. And it'll actually be based on real events in World War II. So the history will be semi-solid. That's, man, I have to say, I can't see a lot of editors going, yeah, we'll take that.
Well, it's, I mean, like, we were, like Liz from LA Weekly wrote an article about Homestuck, the other webcomic,
mm-hmm.
and I've not read it myself, but I started noticing all the kids at the con were wearing Homestuck outfits, and was the way that she describes and the way that other fans have described it to me is that Homestuck makes a great use of the web medium. It doesn't just take a comic book page and paste it on the computer. It uses animation and it uses the interactivity of like asking the fans what they should do next, you know? So there's much more back and forth between the readers, and it's much more dynamic, and it takes advantage of the animation and the color and, you know, the visual storytelling that's possible by having a digital medium. So, I mean, you know, I mean, let's look at what the web comics can do that a paper comic can't do. And that's very appealing.
All right. Zero Intelligence asks, what are your opinions about Weekly Shonen Jump Alpha? Issue zero is out. Anybody take a look at that?
I mean, I looked at it. I'm not, to be honest, I don't really like reading most of my manga in chapter format. So, like, you know, there's a Bakuman chapter, there's a One Piece chapter, but I prefer getting it kind of book-length chunks. But I mean, it, since it's Viz and it's being run through the Viz manga website, it's well presented, it's easy to read, it's easy to access. So as far as, you know, what the presentation, I have no problem with that. I'm sorry to see them, like, leave print, but... Yeah, I think they made a nice move to digital. So if you like Shonen Jump, I don't think there's any reason not to go ahead and get the digital subscription and continue that way.
Provided you have the
device. I will say that I've read it, and it's all killer, no filler. Meaning it, and I do miss some of the filler. Honestly, I miss the articles, I miss the fan art, I miss, you know, some of the other things that made reading the magazine fun. You know, they had like these interviews and features with the artists. They had little backgrounders on the different characters, which I thought was really charming. But, you know, what they've done here is they presented six of the most popular Shonen Jump series and made it very affordable, made it very attractive. I think it's a great move. My only reservation here is I really hope they can find a way to make it available to readers all over the world, not just North America. Because then they'll really have solved the problem of scanlation and
That's the point I was going to make, is they're crowing about how, oh, this is, you know, every chapter is 2 weeks after it comes out in Japan, 2 weeks after it comes out in Japan. And I thought to myself, congratulations, guys, you're still not really fighting piracy. 2 weeks is too long for the kids that consume this stuff like it's crack cocaine. And, like, they're sitting there hitting the refresh button waiting for the next chapter to come up. And the scanlators have it ready the day it publishes in Japan. I mean, yeah, maybe you'll never beat, you know, day and date. But next day, you know, right. 2 days, 2 weeks is too long, guys. I'm sorry. If you really want to fight piracy. But then again, do the people who do that, who obsessively check the, you know, scanlation sites or whatever, are they even interested in paying any money for this stuff? Probably not. So who knows, you know?
Well, and the other problem, and I always forget this, being that I am an adult, is the fact that teenagers don't have credit cards. Yeah. So, you know, having the nice thing about the having a print magazine was you could go in the bookstore, or you could order a subscription, you know, with a check or a money order. You can't do that on the internet. So that's, I mean, I hope they come up with some system of, you know, like gift subscriptions at cons or something where teenagers can go in and pay cash and get online access. If not, then,
you know. They do offer gift subscriptions.
Right.
Where, you know, you could have your parents or someone buy it for you.
Right.
It's not impossible.
It's not impossible, but I think... for a teenager, the sense of, you know, autonomy to be able to buy your own subscriptions is important. And so I'm hoping they'll do something at conventions to kind of encourage people to subscribe there, where they have a little bit more control over the cash instead of having to ask their parents to sign them up.
Yeah, that's the big question mark on this, is that the audience for that is very young. Has that audience migrated sufficiently over to digital to where they can make this a financial success for them? That's the question.
That's a big question. I honestly don't know.
It's an experiment. I'm kind of still surprised that they said, nope, no more print at all. Like, I am really surprised at that. But I guess they saw the savings. They're like, look, we're going to save so much money not printing this magazine.
Well, it's not just that. It's not just the money. It's the resources. I mean, putting out six, translating and putting out a new issue every week, it takes an intense amount of resources, editorial resources. Mm-hmm. So to try to do concurrently a print edition and a digital edition would just kill them. unless they were making a lot of money off of this and could practically double their staff.
I wonder about like the one guy out there who's got like a garage that has nothing but like carefully organized every single issue of Shonen Jump, American Shonen Jump, falling to his knees.
No.
Yeah.
That's
well,
true.
I do feel for the I know the libraries have mentioned that they'll miss it. You know, they'll miss being able to offer a magazine to their patrons.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I do agree. Yeah.
We'll see how that goes. I predict within the next 5 years, if they actually get their act in order, soon you will be able to download your local library's iPad app, and they will have a selection of books for you to choose from, kind of like they have on the Kindle.
That would be nice. I mean, you know, it would be nice to see what, like Viz's venture with Sublime Manga, mm-hmm. with the Libre and Anime, is what they're doing differently than what they're doing with Shonen Jump Alpha. Is there making it available as PDFs. You can download it. You can read it on your Nook or Kindle, you know, and it's worldwide. So, and they basically have said, this is a huge risk for us. And if you guys abuse it, we can't guarantee we're going to continue to be able to do this. But this is something that they said that they were willing to do for the BL market because the readership is older, maybe understands what a gift it is to be able to do that.
Yeah, maybe isn't. Maybe
I don't think they felt the same way with the Shonen Jump crowd.
Didn't grow up with the "I'm going to be an unrelenting asshole about paying for entertainment" mentality.
Yeah. But we'll see. You know, I mean, if the Sublime experiment works well, I mean, this is all so brand new, and I think it's up to fans to do the right thing and see what they're doing with the right intention, and if you want more, then support what they have and maybe you'll give them a reason to do more. But, you know, it's just to demand everything right off the top. You know, I think it's a little unreasonable. I remember talking with Alvin Lewitt Viz and I said, dude, 2E thing. He goes, come on, man, we gotta work up to something.
My big sort of prediction for this year, and it may not happen this year, it might happen next year, but we'll see how fast it happens. I think this year in anime and manga, we are going to see how unrealistic American fan expectations are for this stuff and what that has done to the market. I think we're going to see the fruits of that come to bear. And we will realize that we don't maybe shouldn't act so entitled to expect things for nothing and everything has to be dirt cheap and no, treat this like it's a mainstream product and price it like it's a mainstream product.
Yeah.
Those expectations, I think, are going to sink and fast. But we will find out. That's just my feeling. That's a little tingle in the back of my head for this year.
Yeah, things are definitely changing. I mean, for fans to think that things are going to stay the same price-wise, access-wise,
I don't think so.
Gotta give.
Yeah. All right. ABCB Tom asks, recently titles from Sigiki and Vertical are doing well on the New York Times bestseller list. Do you think more people are giving titles for adults more of a chance?
I hope so.
I think so. I mean, one of the nice things when I was looking at Deb's list was the diversity of critics who were listing manga. You know, you've got people at NPR, you have people at the New York Times. So, I mean, manga, I think, is finally making inroads into that graphic novel readership in general. So people who would pick up Mouse are now maybe willing to give Wandering Sun or Onward Towards Our Noble Death a try. Whereas before, you know, manga is for kids kind of thing. And the fact that, you know, Fantagraphics is putting its name on manga – and Drawn and Quarterly is putting its name on manga, I think is helping a lot too.
Well, they also, you know, take the time to sell the book to a grown-up audience.
Right.
They sell it. They position it. They basically promote it in a way it's not just this one-size-fits-all marketing where you market Naruto the same way you market, say, you know, No Longer Human. You don't market it to the same people. You don't market it the same way. You don't promote it to the same bloggers.
Yeah.
I would, like good Borders, for example, you go to the manga section. If you were brand new to manga, would you know which as a grown up, which title you would like to read?
Yeah.
No.
No, you're right.
I mean, I would, but, you know, your average person would not.
Yes.
Well, I was just going to say, like, I kind of think that a little bit of this is how well these books are talked about and promoted online. I have seen personally, just casually observing, you know, vertical titles being mentioned in places that are not strictly for manga nerds or for anime nerds. You see them mentioned around, and you know, they show up on places like MTV Geek and all that stuff. You know, it feels like they are becoming like that stuff, the Sigiki, the vertical stuff, is, you know, that's part of the Eisner crowd now. That's the Comic-Con crowd. They're aware of that as manga. Like, they that is, you know.
I think one thing I really thought was good that Vertical did was they started showing at non-anime shows as well.
Yeah.
You know, that they started showing at Ape, they started showing at Small Press Expo and at a Toronto Comic Arts Festival, you know, the places where the people who love comics, not necessarily just manga, love comics, go.
Right, and they'll have an idea in their head of manga as Naruto, and then they'll see this and go, oh, this is manga. Oh, okay.
Right, yeah, and getting those books into the hands of reviewers who, and telling them, like, you know, dude, look, this is not, you know, K-On! This is stuff you would enjoy. This art is wonderful. This story is very special. You know, you don't have to know a lot of Japanese. You don't have to understand, like, how Japanese high school works. You don't understand any Japanese words. This is just great art, great story. It's accessible. You'll love it.
Yeah. Well, and Top Shelf put out the AX anthology, and what's nice is, you know, Top Shelf goes to places like SPX and Mocha, and Ponemon/Fanfare goes to shows like SPX and Mocha and Ape. So you're seeing these alternate comic shows are getting a manga presence there, you know, by publishers that are respected by those readers. So, you know, when Fantagraphics brings out like Wandering Sun and takes it to, you know, a Mocha or an Ape or an SPX, those people are willing to give it a shot because that's a trusted name. Same thing with like Top Shelf or anybody else. Right. So yeah, that's encouraging too, is to see is to see more publishers willing to handpick some really good titles for their audience. You know, knowing who reads their books and then finding a manga that fits that audience for them.
All right, CTR. A bunch of numbers asks, do the manga experts think that publishing omnibus volumes is good for the industry? Why or why not?
Yeah, it is. It makes for an affordable entry to a series. Because, you know, like, for example, the Naruto omnibus and Love Hina omnibus, these are all series that have sold very well in the past. So it's by giving new readers a 3-in-1 volume for half the price of what they would pay for buying three. I think it's very appealing.
Yeah, I would agree. And even for things like Sailor Moon, because those are really kind of double volumes. You know, part of it is, I think, just psychologically, if you see that you only have to buy 12 volumes instead of 24, you're a little bit more open to trying a series. So, yeah, I think they work really well, and they are a great price. I mean, Full Metal Alchemist is starting to do the omnibus, so there's a lot of good stuff coming out in that format for people who were a little shy because of the length of some of the series.
Yeah, I don't see how they could possibly be a detriment, especially for a publishing industry rife with, okay, I found volume 1 through 3, 5, 7, 9 through 12. No. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
That wonderful problem too.
Sewing Rose 11, are the new Kodansha releases besides Sailor Moon living up to the hope people had for the company and the products?
Ed, you want to hop on that one?
Well, considering that Kodansha talked to nobody for the longest time, we had no expectations for Kodansha. I mean, we were just happy they were publishing books for a bit. And the fact that I'll be honest, I had exceptionally low expectations because they started out with Ghost in the Shell and Akira. And it took them a long time before they started picking up titles that hadn't been available in print before. So this year at New York Comic Con, them having a booth, them actually doing a panel was really encouraging. It kind of felt like they were finally opening up to the American market and you know, making a presence known. I mean, Sailor Moon has been selling like gangbusters, so I think that'll be an encouragement to kind of get Kodansha to kick them in the butt and to let them know that there's a market here. They just need to kind of commit to it, you know, on the Japanese side. I think Dallas, who is running the American side, is doing all he can, you know, with what he's given. The Japanese side just needs to feel safe being in this market.
I mean, it's a tough time to be a manga publisher. You know, I mean, borders closed. So there went that huge outlet. Books in general are not doing as well as they used to. Comic shops are generally adverse to taking chances on new manga titles. So I very much understand why Kodansha is taking a cautious approach. Here's the nerdy way I spent one weekend. I spent it getting rid of all the dead links to Tokyopop.com, CMXmanga.com, Gokomi.com, on and on and on. It was excruciating, but all of them are dead links. You know, all of them are links to books that are no longer available in print, a company that is no longer around. So, you know, I mean, on one hand, we can kind of look at Kodansha and go, dude, how come so little? And then for me, I look at it like, thank God you're putting out anything.
Right, because it's a really unstable market and no one knows what's going to happen to it this year, just like DVD, just like every other form of packaged physical media. Yeah. Okay. And actually ties into our first segment pretty well, because that's basically what we're talking about there. Okay, I Miss Bionics asks, Bandai bowed out earlier this month. Was there anything that their short-lived manga side put out that you liked?
Well, yeah, I liked Lucky Star. I mean, it was fun. I mean, I'm not going to say it was, like, brilliant, but, I read Four Coma as kind of light reading before I go to sleep. And, as far as Four Coma, it was really well done, and the characters were interesting enough. The only hard part was that around the fifth volume, kept expanding the cast. And so it was getting a little confusing about who was who and what their relations to each other were. So it's a shame that we won't get to see the rest of it. But, if you don't mind the kind of the geek in-jokes, it wasn't a bad series.
I had a hard time with the geek in-jokes. And I'm about as geeky as they come. I like Kanaki. I thought that was kind of cute. I mean, admittedly, this is not a series that I'm heartbroken that I can't read volume 4, but I thought it was nice. It was a nice little series.
Okay, so nothing you're going to run out and snap up before they go completely out of print, if they're not already.
I hate to say it, but no, I'm sorry. I love the Bandai guys. I think they're great, but you know, the appeal of Gundam completely eludes me.
Well, they published stuff that was tied into their anime properties. So it was a lot of K-On, Lucky Star, and a ton of Code Geass stuff that...
And actually here, I'm editing on the next podcast for Manga Out Loud, and we do talk about Bandai in there. And I had forgotten, remember they did the Witchblade adaptations from the anime.
Oh, God. Yeah,
I was like, oh my God, I forgot they even published those books.
I remember when they said they were doing that, we're like, oh, all right, well, you'll probably make some money. All right.
Hey, boobs sell, baby, boobs sell.
They do. Hey, just ask Funimation, man. it's boob month at Funimation right now.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah, it's like 3 fan service shows just this month, and they're all at the top of the Amazon sales trends for anime.
I hope they're giving some portion of this to like breast cancer prevention month.
Lower back research for women.
Yeah.
Oh, lordy.
Ed, you could probably answer this. Redneck Otaku asks, what are some strong science fiction manga titles that have been recently released?
I would recommend, like I said, 7 Billion Needles. I like Twin Spica, 20th Century Boys, Children of the Sea. We talked about Gantz, and those are
sci-fi too, or Dorohedoro.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. I couldn't remember the name of that one.
This is good.
Oh, what's the other one? Is it? It's Bio something.
Biomega. Yes.
Thank you.
Biomega is awesome.
Yeah. The way I would say it is, Vertical is a good publisher. Look at what they're putting out as far as sci-fi, and then the Viz Signature and the Viz Sigaki lines are always good to look at for sci-fi.
What about Marduk Scramble?
Yeah, yeah, that's who is doing that one?
Viz,
that's from Kodansha.
Yeah, Kodansha.
That's Kodansha. Thank you.
Yeah, and
if you like it dark.
Yeah. Well, we were just talking about Gantz. Talk about dark.
Yeah, you know what? I would actually give Marduk Scramble a trophy on that one. Gantz is fucked up, but Marduk Scramble, man. All right. Chibi UFO wants to know, what do we think of the current Sailor Moon manga English translation? This has been a point of contention, of course, I guess.
I don't know. I like it a lot. It reads real well for me. But I never read the Tokyo Pop books, so, and I've never seen the anime, so I have nothing to compare it to be honest with you.
Okay. All right. Deb, you have an opinion?
It's okay. I mean, it's a little nice that it's not Darren and Serena anymore. But, you know,
come on.
I think there's some fans who are upset at some slightly awkward translation choices. But, you know, to tell you the truth, the hardcore fans are just not going to be happy anyway.
They're fans of being upset.
I think
that's what they're fans of. They like being upset. All right. What's Your Name asks, can you guys look into the future and predict what will be the best manga this year? If you can, please do.
I'm going with Samurai Harem, because I heard a rumor that it ends with Galactus showing up and just eating the entire world.
All right, then.
So that's what I heard.
I'm going to play it straight. I think Heart of Thomas is going to be awesome.
Oh, yeah. I hope it really finds an audience. I mean, that's because I want the Poe clan to come over next. So people buy Heart of Thomas so I can get the Poe clan too.
Yeah. Moto Hagio is really amazing. I mean, if we can get as much Moto Hagio here as we have Tezuka, I would be very, very happy.
Oh, and I should say, and Drawn Accordingly can just send me the check whenever they want for the promotions. But we're getting another Mizuki book.
Yes,
it's that's coming out in a couple months, and actually they're doing another I can't remember how to pronounce his name. He did A Drifting Life.
Oh, Tatsumi.
Yes, and they're doing another volume of his work, so I think those are really good. The Mizuki book I'm really interested in because it's semi-autobiographical. It's about how he got interested in yokai, which ties more closely into Gege no Ketero, which is what he's famous for. So if that does well, maybe they'll be encouraged to dip their foot into Gege no Ketero, which is a manga we really should get over here because it's so culturally significant in Japan.
Mm. I mean, for all the yokai stories out there now, I mean, you've got your Blackbird. Oh, how many? I could rattle off so many stories that are just, I mean, Natsumi's
Naru.
Natsume's Book of Friends, all of them about yokai. You know, that's would not even be here without, you know, Shigeru Mizuki. I mean, Non Non Ba, the book that you were just describing, is the book that Shigeru Mizuki book that I was most looking forward to reading because it is most personal, I think. I mean, Onward Towards Our Noble Death, I liked it, but I have to admit it was a bit of a slog to read. It's a lot about military strategy and politics. It's a really dense read, whereas Non Non Ba sounded much more accessible to me. Like, you know, about this woman who tells him ghost stories and, you know, like her interactions with yokai. And that was actually a book that won an award in France as well. So you know, I mean, that's one I really am looking forward to reading. I think, well, the other one, I think I like, I want to read Sakuran by Moyoko Ano. She did.
Oh, yeah.
That one I have in Japanese, and it is gorgeous. It's about a young orphan girl who becomes a geisha, and then she's really rebellious, and it's beautifully drawn and wonderfully told, and it's complete in one volume. The other one that I was really looking forward to, let's see. Attack on Titan sounds really fascinating, actually.
It does, yeah.
The one about the giants have taken over the world.
Yes, yeah. I remember the announcement for that at New York Comic Con, and the artwork looked really interesting, too. So, yeah, that's definitely one I'm going to pick up to check out.
All right. Two questions I'm just going to answer in very rapid succession so we can get through these. I Conquered This asks, do any of you guys think a wider selection of manga will be available for e-readers in the future? Yes. Ahava22 asks, question for manga experts, are more manga or more types of manga published in Europe than in the U.S.? Yes. Ahava asks, the real question I think that was asking, she asked later, basically, should you learn French to read Shoujo and Josei? I guess if you want a wider selection, yes.
Yeah, I've been considering it myself, actually.
And not only a wider selection, but really gorgeous presentations. The French editions of, like, Faith Aaron Hicks, who is a Canadian comic creator, was in a French bookstore in Canada and took pictures of the French editions of Pluto, and I couldn't stop drooling. They were gorgeous. They were hardbound. It's really hard not to to be tempted to pick up French just to get some of those editions, particularly Rose of Versailles. If you're going to read Rose, if you want to read it, you have to learn Japanese to French.
And finally, from Ahava22, what's the best way to reach out to a publisher if you want a title to continue?
Ooh. Buy it. Buy lots of it, to be honest.
Tell all your friends to buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously a lot of the publishers now have Twitter feeds, have Facebook. You know, mm-hmm. you can make your case, but obviously money talks. So do make your best effort. If you really love a series, make your best effort to buy it, or tell your friendly neighborhood library to buy it for you, or tell your friends to pick it up. Because honestly, that's what counts.
Yeah, and I mean, and talk it up on, if you have a Facebook or Twitter account, talk it up on Facebook and Twitter to get some word of mouth going, to get some interest in it. You know, because unfortunately, at the end of the day, regardless of how good the series is, or regardless of how passionate its fan base is, publishers have to make money. And so, if it isn't selling, then they're not going to be able to publish it.
I mean, the digital does offer some opportunity for some discontinued series or some series on hiatus to be published somehow. But still, that's something that publishers haven't quite gotten on board with yet in total. I mean, when I've talked to the J-Manga people, they said, yes, that's definitely something they want to do. They want to be able to continue the series that, say, Tokyo Pop, you know, canceled, or CMX canceled, or so on and so forth. But, you know, so far they haven't quite delivered on that intention. I mean, it's still only 6 months in, so hopefully they will soon at some point. But there's also print on demand, which has been explored, not very extensively, but it would be lovely at some point to, like, there's several Viz titles that are out of print and are very, very hard to find. It would be nice to be able to get it print on demand. Say, like, oh, you know, I just want Boss Out of Volume 19 without paying $300. Can I get it print on demand? That'd be swell.
Yeah, that would be nice. Also, well, just to bring stuff back, I mean, I'd love to see Monster available digitally. You know, I keep hitting up every time I see a Viz rep. That's what I keep telling them is, you know, put Monster on the Viz manga. And Gintama just got canceled, so fans of that might want to see if Viz would be willing to do it digitally. I mean, yeah, don't give up on a series. Yeah, I would say, you know, Since most publishers now have some kind of digital presence, see if you can convince them to go digital, because the print sales might not be there, but there might be enough digital sales to keep it alive.
All right. All good suggestions. If you like a product and you want to see more of it, buy it. Fancy that. Yeah.
It's really not rocket science, people.
Yeah, no. It is, I guess in this day and age it is. It's like, what? Pay to be entertained? Yeah. All right, guys. Well, listen, it's been swell. It's been great fun having you on. Thanks again so much for coming back.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And we'll see you next time. Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Deb and Ed for stopping by once again. Theme song is called Bucharest by the band New Division. You can check them out at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. We would really appreciate it. And see you all next week.